everybody, and welcome to the Big Web Show, Everything Web That Matters. I'm your host, Jeffrey Zeldman, and with me today is my dear friend, author of Adaptive Web Design, Crafting Rich Experiences with Progressive Enhancement, Mr. Aaron Gustafson. Aaron, hi.
Hey, Jeffrey, how you doing?
I'm good. Where are you today?
I am in Chattanooga.
And
Tennessee.
I understand.
Tennessee.
Tell me about the blanket.
I'm actually podcasting from the Chattanooga Open Device Lab, which is a room with some fairly solid flat walls that are full of echo. So I've got a blanket hung behind me on the rear window just to cut down on that echo. So
what's in the device? Yeah. What's in the device lab? Does it really need that much space? Are there that many devices? It's a big echoing space.
We have about 50 devices, I think, wow, of varying sorts. We've got two big cabinets of phones and tablets. We have, I guess it's probably about a 12-foot long table that's got a bunch of laptops and different monitors, because I think a lot of things, you know, we talk a lot about device testing, but we don't often talk about monitor testing, and monitors are calibrated wildly differently.
Right.
And, you know, if you're used to working on an Apple Cinema display or just on your Apple laptop or something like that, it's a vastly different experience from like a $200 Samsung monitor or something like that. So we've got a bunch of monitors set up too, so that we can check color calibration and that sort of stuff.
I hadn't thought about that, and I should have, because I'm very well aware of that pain point. I wish I could talk about a book about web color management that might be coming soon from somewhere, but that's not today's subject. You're in a device lab, and early on in your book, you talk about an experience where you spent 15% of the budget testing for basically every device, and 40%, whereas previously you'd spent 40% of the budget testing for three devices, very standard, obvious devices. I think it was iPhone, Android, and iPhone, iPad, and desktop. I'm not sure. Yeah.
Okay, so there were two pieces to that. The first one was the one that was the three platform thing. We had a project that we did, and I blogged about this on the Easy Designs blog a couple of years ago when we did it. But we did an app for the Chrome Web Store. This was back when the Chrome Web Store was brand spanking new. In fact, it hadn't even opened when we were working on this app. And so we built it targeting Chrome, or actually what was supposed to be a future version of Chrome, because they told us basically do what Safari is able to do now, and Chrome will be able to do that by the time the Chrome Store launches, in terms of like 3D transforms and all that sort of stuff. But we did that aiming just at Chrome.
How long ago was this?
This was 2010, I think, something like that.
Yeah, because that seems like it's another century.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was
that's the
five
words
years
that just came out of your mouth. Yeah,
yeah, okay. Yeah. It was 5 years ago.
Okay. Please continue.
So we did that, and that was targeting just that one browser. And obviously, since they told us to model it on Safari, it worked in Safari as well as working in Chrome. And they wanted us to do it all in like cutting edge web tech, because Google was funding this project for WikiHow, because they wanted to have some good content in the store when they launched. And so we built that, and then they we had done like WebDB and some other cutting edge tech. And then they came back to us about 9 months later, and they wanted to redo that site, or not redo the site, but they wanted to add support for the then current version of Firefox and the then current version of IE, which was IE9. And I want to say Firefox 14, maybe.
And this was one of those rare cases where you hadn't designed with progressive enhancement, right?
They told us that we basically couldn't, because they wanted us to use this like cutting edge stuff, and they wanted us to use a lot of proprietary web.
Exactly.
Kits. Yeah.
So this is not what you do ordinarily.
Right.
Not what you're advising people to do generally.
No.
But this was a very specific project for the manufacturer of a browser that wanted to show off what they could do.
And it was only really targeting the app store. So it would you know, essentially, even though it existed as a website, it was a web app.
You're not going to go to the app store, the Chrome App Store in Opera or in IE or even in Safari.
So we were able to, you know, we kind of justified not using progressive enhancement on it in that scenario.
Sure.
And then when they came back to us to do this, we were like, okay, well, we're kind of screwed, because the WebSQL spec is not moving forward. In fact, it's been abandoned by the W3C. IndexedDB, which was the replacement for that, which was being pushed for by the folks at Mozilla and the folks at Microsoft, they hadn't implemented it yet because it was still kind of theoretical. So what we ended up having to do, because we were doing a lot of client-side data storage, is I ended up writing a SQL wrapper that basically mapped all of the stuff that we were doing in WebSQL over to using local storage in the browser, which I was able to actually make it work all the way back as far as IE6 even, which was kind of cool.
But, so just so I understand, you weren't basically running, you weren't doing what like the Facebook app used to do, right? Where you're running one browser inside another browser. You're not doing that.
No, okay. We didn't do anything like that. We didn't use Chrome Frame, which I suppose we could have, forced somebody to download Chrome Frame or something, but we didn't want to do that.
No.
We wanted to use the native stuff. So we made it work for Firefox. I think it was Firefox 14, as I said, and IE9. And so we couldn't get the animations because IE didn't support animations at that point. And transitions, but we were able to, obviously it would just toggle between the different states, which was fine. It was a nice fallback, but we had budgeted about 40% of the original project budget to add those two browsers. And I think we ended up going over by at least 5% of that, maybe 10% of that. So it may have ended up being a bit more like half of the original project cost to add two more browsers. Now, the other story that I shared was a project that we did, for a pretty major company that I can't name, unfortunately.
Sure.
But they had come to us because they were experiencing a pain point where their apps, they're a very security conscious company. So their apps need to be very secure. And they had an app for iPhone, a separate app for iPad, and then a kind of a generic Android app. And they wanted to be able to upgrade the security on that, upgrade the login security and such without much difficulty. And the way that it was having to go now or at the time was that everything was web service driven. So they would upgrade the web service, then they would have to upgrade each and every one of those apps to take advantage of that web service. They'd have to add in whatever screens they needed to support things like, an authentication token or a challenge response question or something like that. And then get that change published and approved by the various app stores and then cross their fingers and hope users downloaded it, because at that time we didn't even have the automatic updates stuff that we do now within wow. iOS. So it was a security nightmare. And so they came to us and they were like, we'd really like to re-envision this as a web-based login. So basically throw open a web view within whichever app it is, take them through the login process on the web server, and then basically do a handshake over from the server to the app to let the app know that, this is the person who logged in. So we did that for them, and we were only targeting, iOS on the iPhone, which I think was the iPhone 4 maybe at the time, the iPad, and I think the iPad mini may have just come out when we were in testing mode. We were testing on a couple of different Android devices, some tablets and some phones. And then we threw in Windows Phone because they had said that they were talking about maybe doing a Windows Phone app. So we threw that in and we built them a pattern library, and we built the whole thing with progressive enhancement in mind because that's what they were hiring us to do. And so it wasn't right. relying on JavaScript and all of this other stuff, and it would just work. We then handed that off to them, and I think our budget was in the very, very low six figures, for that project, but we handed off a ton of material to them, and they kind of took that and ran and built out all the remaining screens they needed to. I think we had done like 35 of them or something like that, and they needed to do like 100 more. But anyway, so we handed that stuff off to them, and then they came back to us about 6 months later, and they're like, this is working really well for the apps. We have this M.dot site. We'd really like to roll login to the M.dot site. Here's a list of 1,400 devices that just UA strings that were accessing the login screen over 2 days. And so before we could even budget for that, I ended up having to write a script to basically parse all of those user agent strings in order to get some details about all the devices and try.
Yeah, what's the background on that? How did you how did you write that script? What was the logic behind it? How did you figure that out? What language did you use?
So I wrote it in PHP, and it's up on my GitHub. And I published it out there because I found it pretty useful. And I'm blanking this morning because I've been getting very little sleep. We have a new puppy that's to go out like every 2 to 3 hours. So it's, my brain's a little fried, but I used one of the online services to basically get device information back based on the user agent string. And it's in the, I'll post you the link so we can include it in the show notes.
It's in your book too.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
You have a permacc.cc link to it.
Yeah. Yep. So that script basically went out and captured any sort of information that I could get from that service in terms of the device information, the screen size, the operating system, the browser version, so that I could begin aggregating all of that. And then I believe we were able to kind of aggregate things down to about 23 devices that were representative of about 97% of that spectrum.
Yeah, that's a wonderful achievement just in itself.
Yeah,
rerun that script every so often to because I imagine with new devices coming online all the time.
So my hope, and I'm trying to get this project together right now, but my hope is to actually turn that into a kind of a free service for folks.
Like a free product, yeah.
Yeah, that basically you could either, you know, upload or maybe connect it to your Google Analytics or I don't know, something like that. It's still kind of all up in the air, but the idea would be to parse your specific stats and kind of temper that with what's going on in terms of sales data and which devices we should be looking out for that may not be showing up yet, but are worth considering. And trying to, like, some of that's going to be a little bit of fuzzy logic, not necessarily, just numbers based data, but trying to put together a good picture of these are the sorts of devices you should be testing on. And maybe even if I can work it out with the Open Device Lab folks, like here, if you don't have these devices to test on, here are some device labs close to you that you can find these devices if you need to go test.
It's funny that in spite of web standards and progressive enhancement and all that, we still have to do this last mile. We still have to do almost behave as if this stuff standards don't exist and, you know, find the little bugs and gremlins in these different devices. And that's been true forever. You remember like browser watch and stuff? We used to worry about how's it going to look when we were foolishly trying to make pixel perfect layouts or our clients were insisting this has to look the same in every browser, right? You remember that?
Yep, absolutely.
There were all kinds of services out there that would just say, oh, it's a little bit, there's a little gap under the headlines in this browser and this version of this browser and this version of this operating system. And, you know, the client actually might make a fuss about that. Mm-hmm. And you might have to do crazy. But here, we're not trying to do crazy.
Nope.
Right here.
We're trying to do sane and build up. Yeah.
You have a wonderful story early in your book. That's sort of I have a superhero origin story, which is you have your superhero origin story about progressive enhancement. And before I ask you yours, I'm just going to tell you. So mine was in the late 1980s. I was a musician, and I had a small studio. And back then, for a reasonable amount of money, you could put together a 4 or even an 8-track studio that was professional. But you were pretty limited in what you could do with it. And Akai had just come out with this thing called the Akai 12-track. And for the same money as basically a professional 4-track studio, you could have a 12-track studio with 2 sends. And it was an amazing device, right? It synced with SMPTE. It synced with MIDI. You could be running drum machines and sequencers and triggering computer patches to change, synth patches that you'd programmed in computers to change. This is like really, like I said, it's the late 80s. So I'm using very archaic language, but this was a wonderful device. And I really grew as a musician because I was able to collaborate with others. I was able to compose and record all kinds of stuff. And I really got into all that. And I had a lot of music on these multi-track masters. And then Akai discontinued the series because it just didn't catch on. It didn't become a new standard. It didn't, you know.
Yep.
Standards are just agreements, right? In any industry, standards are just agreements. And since only Akai was making it and their competitors didn't say, well, we can make that too. There was an interim period where Akai went, you know what, we can use regular Betamax tapes instead of our proprietary 12-track format. And that screwed me because basically they came out with a new series of models that just ran those tapes. So my tapes were already obsolete. Then they basically just discontinued it because there wasn't enough, because that's what happens when you try a new product. Most products die. So I had all this music and I really couldn't do anything with it. I had all this music on these master tapes, some of which I still have in dirty little cobweb covered closets in little parts of my home with it, that I don't look at lest I weep. And I just, it was very, and I don't blame the company for trying something and I don't blame the company for going out of business, but it sort of, it made me think that there was a reason that these more, you know, that maybe if you jump, if there was this cool innovation, but it wasn't a standard, there was a very good chance it wasn't going to catch on, and maybe that wasn't the way to do things. And later when I became a web designer, just about, you know, less than 10 years later, right? I was, standards just made sense to me. And you have an experience that put you down the road to progressive enhancement. You talk about it early in your book.
My first web experience?
Yes, yeah. Your first web experience where you said this... We can't swear on the show, so we'll say bull crap, okay? But
the kids.
Yeah, the kids.
Yeah. My first experience of the World Wide Web back in college. So this is, 1994 or 5, I don't remember. But the college that I went to, New College down in Sarasota, Florida, basically, you didn't have a direct connection to the internet in your room. You had to connect to the central server for the university. You basically had to dial into that, and then that would connect you to the internet. And the only way to do that at the time was through Gopher, basically. So it was all terminal based. It was all effectively, you know, white or green text on a black background, So I finally said, oh, you know, I'm gonna check out what this whole World Wide Web thing is. And so I connected to the server and I wasn't terribly, I mean, I had been using computers since I was young, but I wasn't super, you know, computer savvy. I mean, I could find my way around DOS and stuff like that, but I definitely was not nearly as steeped in the world of computers as I am today. But I managed to do everything I needed to connect to the server and then get out on the internet. And I was a huge music fan. And I think that was the year I actually started a music magazine in college. But so I was like, I'm
cool.
I want to see what Sony's doing. So I went to sonymusic.com and literally all I saw were the words image, 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 image in square brackets at various positions across the page, because they were using tables for layout and they were using image maps and they were using text embedded in images and they didn't have any alt text or anything.
I wish we could show the screenshot that's in your book. I wish this podcast had screenshot. It's a Lynx-like experience, right? It's a Lynx screenshot. Okay. And it's just...
Yeah, so I was trying to reappropriate trying to recreate what my experience was like back then. It's basically an interpretation. It's not the exact thing. I tried on the Wayback Machine as hard as I could to get back to that old version of the Sony site, but I couldn't find the exact experience that I had. So
write about that too in your book. Yeah. It's not just that browsers. I mean, what we create, the devices and the browsers and the operating systems all become obsolete too. So what? Yeah. If we don't have, right, like you talk about the problem Tim Berners-Lee was trying to solve, which was the built-in obsolescence in everything. And he did solve it. And then we go out of our way to screw that up with our innovations. But exactly. I just love this shot, this screenshot. It just says like text.gif dash 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 enter.gif submit.
Yep.
And
yep.
That was my
web experience.
And that's like...
That was bullcrap.
It's supposed to be music, right? It's supposed to be music.
Yeah. They have this. It's supposed to be information about their bands and about the CDs they have coming out. Yeah. And I got nothing. And so yeah, that I guess kind of is. I hadn't thought about it as my superhero origin story for Progressive Enhancement, but it definitely is. It really colored my way of experiencing the web and really got me to think about how different people access the internet in different ways and necessarily so. And, you know, later on, my school got a point-to-point protocol connection, and I got a copy of, I don't know, Netscape 2 or whatever it was at the time, and, you know, finally saw the web for the first time visually and things, you know, I was like, oh, okay, you know, I see what's going on. And then, you know, eventually I taught myself how to build web pages.
Mosaic, Netscape.
Yep. Mosaic and Netscape and yeah, all that fun early stuff. I think I was still on, I may have been on Windows 3.1 at the time. I don't know. It was olden days. But yeah, it was definitely, it colored my perception of the internet. And I think that has been one of the things that I keep coming back to and thinking about when I'm trying to build experiences. And I think that's why, you know, my first exposure to web standards was actually in, I want to say 2001, when I was working at Gartner, and I was, I just happened upon the Elista Part site. And it was an article that Eric Meyer had done about print style sheets and how to use generated content to,
sure,
to display the link addresses in print versions of web pages. And I was like, this is friggin' amazing. You know, this is a really beautiful and elegant thing. And I mean, I had tinkered with some embedded style sheets when I was learning HTML, but I really didn't understand what style sheets were all about. And I think that was when I really got the bug for web standards, and then became passionate about learning about them and about, you know, proselytizing for web standards and all that sort of stuff. And then,
well, you certainly became, I don't, an evangelist, and I don't know what, I think you, I don't know what to call you. Actually, Jeremy Keith talks about that in his intro, and he calls you teacher.
Yeah.
But you certainly have become a very passionate advocate for this way of building, of creating experiences for people, which is another thing I want to talk about after I do a quick sponsor read. But one of the things I love about the way you approach design and the way you've always approached technology is that you, in spite of your massive experience with and understanding of all these different layers of technology, you never lose sight of the fact that we're creating these things, experiences for people. I love that. It's all over this book. That's why this is one of my favorite books. Adaptive Web Design is the book. We're going to come back and talk about it some more in just a minute. But first, I would like to thank one of our dear sponsors. Now, we've been talking about the web in the old days. And if you'd been around the web in the old days, you would probably know this sponsor. They have been around since 1997. Since 1997, DreamHost has helped entrepreneurs and developers the world over bring their dreams to life on the internet. They offer domain registrations, web hosting, and even powerful cloud storage and computing services. There are 1.5 million plus websites, WordPress blogs, and applications hosted by DreamHost. More than 400,000 customers spanning 100,000. I'm sorry. Wow. I got so excited by what I was saying that the last one was nonsense. More than 400,000 customers spanning over 100 countries, not 100,000 countries. I don't think there are 100,000 countries. More than 400,000 customers spanning over 100 countries trust DreamHost to be their online home. Packed with value, DreamHost is the best place to launch a blog, website, or web application into the stratosphere. They're home to over 750,000 WordPress installs. And their helpful staff of professional WordPress experts has been recommended over and over. DreamHost is the proud winner of PC Magazine's Business Choice Award for Best Web Hosting Service and has been a recommended hosting solution by WordPress since 2005. They have award-winning in-house support staff who are available 24 hours a day via live chat and email. And it's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. You can call them on the craziest holiday with a problem and they will answer and they will help you. So I'm not saying just for laughs, try to make something go wrong on your website on Christmas Day, for example, but if you did, they would have your back. DreamHost is giving the listeners of this show a special offer. Visit DreamHost.com to sign up and make sure to use the code The Big Web Show 395. The Big Web Show 395. Use that code at checkout and you'll get top rated web hosting for just $3.95 a month. I got to say that again, $3.95 a month for web hosting. That's insane. Seriously, that is such an incredible value. Plus, you'll get a free domain name, right? So sign up at dreamhost.com with code TheBigWebShow395 for $3.95 a month, web hosting, $3.95 a month, and a free domain name. Thank you, DreamHost, for supporting 5x5 and The Big Web Show. And we are back with Mr. Aaron Gustafson, author of Adaptive Web Design, Crafting Rich Experiences with Progressive Enhancement, second edition. I want to talk about the second edition and what's new, which is a lot. But first, I just want to read something that you wrote, Aaron, if you don't mind.
No.
This is why... I mean, I love this book for a number of reasons. One is that it's incredibly thorough, and it gets its hands very dirty and dives way down into the code, but it also is strategic and high level, and you could hand it to a manager. You could hand it to someone who's never made a website, and they would still understand all the design principles in it and all the thinking, and they would basically sign off on progressive enhancement and web standards as a way of development just from reading this book. It's an incredible book, and it's very up-to-date. It is the most up-to-date general approach to web standards-based design that I know of. But why I love this book is the humanism of it, and I'm going to read you just the opening page of chapter one. This will take a couple minutes. I'm just reading Aaron's words, but I think they're worth reading. The one, chapter one, designing experiences for people. The one constant on the web is change. There's always a new design fad, a new darling language, framework, or tool, a shiny new device to view it on, or new ideas of what it means to be on the web. It's exceptionally difficult to wrap your head around an industry that is constantly in flux. It makes my head hurt, and if you've been working on the web for a while, I suspect you might feel the same. Having worked on the web for nearly two decades, I've seen the cycle play out over and over. Java applets, Shockwave, Flash, Prototype, jQuery, 960GS, Bootstrap, Angular, React. Technologies come and go, but the web remains. Screens went from tiny to huge and then back to tiny again, but the web remains. Walled gardens were built and then torn asunder to make way for app stores and, yes, more walled gardens, but the web remains. The web remains because it is not a fixed screen size. The web remains because it is not a specific device. The web doesn't need to be installed. The web is inherently resilient and infinitely malleable. The web has the capacity to go anywhere, do anything, and reach anyone. I tell you, honestly, I'm verklempt.
You gave me chills reading it. So you may need to do the audiobook version of this.
Okay. I mean, this is what I think we both love so much about the web. And this is what we, even though both of us had initial experiences of the web as like, oh, that's not very attractive. Oh, that seems really slow and hard to understand. I mean, my initial experience of the web, for me, I had been using AOL.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, well, and AOL is so nicely branded. It's a designed user experience. I feel so safe and comfortable. Exactly. There's always guide copy. They'd figured out a lot of online user experience. And then I looked at Netscape 1.0, and I don't even remember what site, some commercial site. With, you know, the initial sites were terrible mm-hmm. as user experience. But I think for both of us, what clicked early on is that this thing is for everybody. And you and what's great about your book is you tell how to make the thing that works for everybody and then enhance on top of that over and over again. You say a couple of things in the book. You make big points of saying some certain things that I think would be controversial to a lot of people. I'll start with the less controversial one, and you come to it first, which is you say You claim that visual design is an enhancement. And I think that is a tough proposition for, that is a tough proposition for designers. That is a tough proposition for brand managers to swallow, for corporations that are used to printing brochures and advertisements and approving every frame of every commercial. And suddenly you're saying that what they're making goes beyond and transcends, and it almost, and that there can be many experiences of the visual design and it almost doesn't matter. So can you explain how you approach this in the book and how you make the case? Obviously you took a whole book to make these cases, but if you could just do it in a few minutes, when you say visual design is an enhancement, what does that mean to you?
Well, I mean, I think your example of the brand managers is kind of an interesting one, because, you know, we talk about brand, and a lot of people, when you say brand, they think of a logo. But your brand isn't the logo. Your brand is an idea in the minds of your customers or your potential customers or your former customers, right? It exists as this amorphous thing, and you're trying to shape that concept. And so to me, I mean, I really like Steph Hay refers to every interface as a conversation. And I think coming back to that idea of, what is the conversation that I want to have with my users? How do I want to contribute to that conversation? How do I want them to view me? Do I want them to view me as an authority? Do I want them to view me as a partner? How do I engage them in a way that they trust what I'm saying?
And designers should certainly be used to this, because one of the basic design exercises we do over and over again is we say, if you were a car, what kind of car would you be? If you were a soft drink, so we're used to getting the client to or if we work internally, if we work in-house, getting ourselves to think, how do we translate this outside of, right, before we talk about what does it do on the screen, right? Before we start thinking in terms of product and boxes, what is the website like? What is the book like? Instead of that, we think, what is the brand experience at all levels, in all kinds of ways, even in things that we don't do yet? If we were a rocket ship, what kind of rocket ship would we be? That's probably a terrible example, but yeah. Okay, please continue. So this is something, my point is just that's something you can say to brand people and designers, and they get it.
Yeah. And so to me, like that's the core. And that was when I came about or decided that I really wanted to do an update to this book, and calling it a second edition and an update is probably doing it a little bit of a disservice, because the original book was like 135 in terms of pages, and this one is like 265. So it's a substantial amount more, but it's also 95% new material. So it is basically a new version entirely of the original adaptive web design. But when I set about kind of figuring out how I wanted to frame it, I had kind of glossed over content strategy in the first chapter of the first edition, and just kind of said that you should be doing this before you get to the coding, and just kind of left it at that. And so in this one, I actually wanted to take and do an entire chapter just talking about content, because if we don't think about that conversation, if we don't think about how it is that we're trying to address our users and how we're crafting the experience, like, that's the foundation, right? That's the universal baseline for everyone, no matter what device they happen to be on, is, you know, what is the text content? What are the images we're choosing? And a lot of that then affects, you know, how well we can make the page perform. Like if we're having a ton of images in there, you know, that may not be a good thing for performance.
Right.
It sets up a lot of stuff.
You talk about, it's interesting because you say like, performance is not something your system administrator needs to think about. It's something you actually need to think about when you think about content. You're constantly like cross-pollinating or basically breaking down silos in the book, I think, and just talking about how we all need to be involved at every step in all these decisions, because they're experience decisions, and that's really design.
Exactly. And so, I mean, a lot of this came out of, I guess it's been like the last 3 or 4 years, I've been doing a lot of workshops under either the term adaptive web design or like beyond responsive, where I've done them both at conferences and then internally for companies, where I work with them to get together a very heterogeneous group of people, or heterogeneous group of people, to come together and talk about interface. So we try and get people who are focusing on content. We even try and get folks who are focusing on SEO and the designers and the developers, and get them all in a room and get them working on small mixed teams to break down those barriers. Because I think there is so much overlap and there's so much input that can be had from one team to another. You know, the kind of the old way we used to build websites was very much the waterfall process. You know, we use the term throwing it over the wall from one team to another. Mm-hmm. But I don't think we built good products that way. And so with the advent of Agile, people are getting used to this idea of working in more mixed teams. And I think we end up getting better products that way, because a developer can have, you know, input on the content strategy. A content strategist can have input on the development. And, you know, there becomes a greater opportunity for empathy within the team and an understanding of what every person's role is and what they bring, and not necessarily that, you know, I'm the designer. I am the only one who gets to touch the visual, you know, look and feel of this site, and nobody can say, you know, a damn thing about it.
Do you get pushback? The way you say it, it sounds like people from these different entrenched fiefdoms come together in the workshop and just sort of have a kumbaya moment and everybody's happy. But do you ever have situations when you're doing these workshops where one group really has difficulty talking to another? And if so, how do you fix that?
So it's happened on occasion. In most cases, they've been smaller companies that I've been dealing with, not so many of the very large corporate kind of behemoths that have a lot of those fiefdoms. I have done it in some companies that are like that. But in most cases, the people are at least a little bit familiar with each other and what they do.
Right.
But there have been some where, you know, it's like the table has been very quiet because the people don't necessarily speak the same language. And so I take those groups through the arc that I do in the book, basically, which is, you know, what is like, let's
start with content.
Yeah.
Then move to markup.
Everybody gets an interface.
Every team's talking about markup too, which is unusual, right? Everybody thinks about markup, then everybody thinks about.
Yep. And obviously there are some people who have a greater understanding of the implications of certain markup decisions or certain design decisions or certain JavaScript decisions than other people on the team. But that's where a conversation comes in. So I get them focused around a specific interface. And the core thing I put to them is, what are you trying to enable somebody to do? What is the core task they need to be able to accomplish? Because that's what every decision you make needs to be made with regard to. Because as soon as you make a decision that undermines that, you've undermined your entire interface, your entire page, potentially your entire website.
Well, not only will that keep, that's brilliant, and will keep everything focused on the end user and what they need to do and what you want them to do, but it also is the way, I think, probably, that you sell your most controversial book section, which is interaction is an enhancement. Because if I have heard people, and I'm sure you hear this too, people are like, well, see, we make really complex apps, so progressive enhancement isn't for us. Like progressive enhancement isn't really necessary, because this app is for people with specific, you know, with advanced browsers and who have JavaScript turned on. And so I don't really need this to work in a Palm Pilot or whatever. How do you approach that? Is it in the framework that I just mentioned, you know, the same workshop? Right. How do you talk to your own customers, your own clients, on that issue of interaction is an enhancement? In other words, interaction is something that we can achieve multiple ways. It's not a given. This happens with, you know, this little window flies up and the user hits this big button or nothing happens. How do you sell the flexibility of how you approach interaction?
So I think the first thing that I try to get people to understand is that, you know, every site, every product that we build for the web is different, right? So everything has different needs. If you're building an online photo editor, yeah, that's probably going to be kind of painful to do in a non-JavaScript scenario. You know, there are going to be certain things that you are going to necessarily have to make lots of round trips to the server. But there are ways to achieve that without driving yourself nuts. And it's become, I would say, even easier in the modern world of Node, because with Node.js, we can actually execute JavaScript on the server as well. So you can have complex logic that is shared between the client and the server. And if the client is unable to handle it, you can pass that off to the server and you just have full page refreshes, which is what we used to do in Web 1.0 right. and most of Web 2.0. You know, these, we're not building, by and large, we are not building stuff that we haven't built before. You know, most of the things that we have on the web now, with the possible exception of photo editors and the possible exception of, you know, online IDEs and stuff like that, most of that has existed since pretty much the beginning of the commercial web.
Right. We're making it slicker. We're making it more app-like.
And I'm all for that. I think there's a lot of things that we can do to enhance the experience for people who do have modern devices. But at the same time, I don't want to sacrifice reach. I think a really interesting example, and I'm probably going to be writing up a blog post or an article about this soon, but I think there's a lot to be said for creating opportunities for people outside of your comfort zone and your kind of bubble or realm of experience to be able to use your products. So, you know, if you take WhatsApp, for instance, WhatsApp's one of, what, like 1,200 chat apps in the iOS app store? And I don't know.
Are you hearing laughter in the background, by the way?
Is that Ava?
That, yes, my daughter is home sick with a cold, and she was, so I'm working from home today, and she was sleeping, but she's up now, and she's not laughing at you.
She's very happy. Say hi for me.
Which is what we want. I will. Yes. I will. So you were sorry. That was WhatsApp. No. I think you got derailed by the laughter. WhatsApp is one of 1,200 chat apps in the...
Yeah. So if I don't know anybody who works on WhatsApp. So I'm doing some conjecturing here, but I'm imagining that most of the people who work on WhatsApp are probably on a Mac or on some sort of, you know, more high powered device and that sort of thing. But what's really interesting to me is that they went out to other platforms outside of kind of our traditional, you know, let me just say the Silicon Valley mentality of mm-hmm. you know, who we should be targeting, and they have a J2ME version. And, you know, that really allowed them to explode in Asia and so in India and China. And that's what allowed them to get up to, you know, 600 million users. I think they had when they were acquired by Facebook for what, $19 billion. They created an opportunity for people who were not being well served by other options and were being, I would imagine, largely ignored by a lot of the chat applications. And they were able to create a product that worked for them. They created an opportunity for those people to use their product, and they reaped massive rewards for it. And I look to some of the stuff that my employer, Microsoft, is doing in terms of, like, they have the Azure cloud, which is their answer to Amazon Web Services and that sort of thing. And when you think Microsoft cloud, you might think, oh, okay, a bunch of, you know, IIS servers and stuff like that. But I mean, they've embraced Linux and you can run, you know, Linux servers and stuff like that within the Azure cloud. They went outside of their comfort zone, and they've, you know, they've even, I think, open sourced the Linux version that they're using on the cloud and such. They're supporting Node backends. They're supporting, you know, PHP backends and all this other stuff, which is pretty interesting. And then, you know, at the same time, they're also, you know, with Office, you know, they've always had a Mac version of Office, but they've been actively getting Office onto Android and onto iOS and moving outside of that Windows only realm where, you know, obviously they've been very dominant. But I think that speaks to trying to create opportunities for more people to engage with their products. I mean, I think that's another thing that's been huge for Opera. I mean, the reason that Opera is and is often overlooked by people in our industry, Opera is the largest mobile browser, but I would wager that probably, you know, in my experience, like talking to teams, I would say, you know, maybe 15% of them are actually testing on Opera Mobile and Opera Mini.
Certainly in America.
Yeah, certainly in America. And you know, they're huge, and they serve billions upon billions of pages. And I think that they were able to do that because they're available on pretty much every operating system. I mean, you can use them on your Nintendo DS, right? Like you can use Opera on the Wii.
We have to pause here. Sorry, this is great stuff, but I have to thank another sponsor. We good?
Go for it.
Okay. This episode of the Big Web Show is brought to you by Braintree, which is code for easy online payments. If you're building a mobile app and searching for a simple payment solution, check out Braintree. The Braintree V.0 SDK makes it easy to offer multiple mobile payment types. Start accepting PayPal, Apple Pay, Bitcoin, Venmo, cards, and more, all with a single integration. With Braintree V.0 SDK, it's one small snippet of code and you're set up in less than 10 minutes. Simple, secure payments you can integrate in minutes. Developers, if you don't have time or you don't have expertise, give them a call and they'll handle the integration for you and walk you through it. The Braintree code, just like we were talking about a moment ago, the Braintree code supports Android, iOS, and JavaScript clients and has SDKs in 7 languages, .NET, Node.js, Java, Perl, PHP, Python, and Ruby. It's just 10 simple lines of in-app code, and that's elegant code with clear documentation. To learn more, and for your first $50,000 in transactions, fee-free, go to braintreepayments.com/bigwebshow. This episode is also brought to you by Thinkful. Learn to build websites and apps in 3 months with HTML, CSS, JavaScript, and jQuery. One-on-one mentorship comes with Thinkful. You're paired with an experienced engineer who you meet with once a week, and you build a job-ready portfolio. Thinkful is available for multiple skill levels, right? It's for beginners who want to be engineers, for designers who want to learn code, for people who have good skills but want to be like Aaron, our guest today, and have amazing skills. Thinkful provides online design and coding classes with a heavy emphasis on one-on-one mentorship. That's what sets them apart from competitors. They know that access to experts helps their students learn more quickly and efficiently. During the course, students meet with a personal mentor through video chat and receive ongoing feedback on their projects. Students also have access to office hours with mentors and an online community where they can post and receive feedback. Thinkful courses are designed for a range of learners from beginner to intermediate. They have introductory courses that teach students how to build websites and mobile apps from scratch. And they have intermediate courses designed for more experienced programmers who are looking to upskill by learning a new language or framework. Additionally, students have the ability to customize their courses with feedback from their mentor based on prior experience or current skill level. It's really deep one-on-one stuff. For 20% off on Thinkful, go to thinkful.com/bigwebshow. That's thinkful.com/bigwebshow. Thank you, Thinkful. And we are back with Aaron talking about adaptive web design, crafting rich experiences with progressive enhancement, second edition from Pearson, new riders. What was it? You published independently the first time that you wrote the book, and you went to for this much larger, 95% new, almost you could have slapped a new title on it and called it something different. You went to New Riders. What was that experience like, and why did you decide to do that?
So since taking the position with Microsoft and kind of changing things up, my life's been a little bit more hectic. I've had a lot more travel and stuff like that. And you know, as you know, running a publishing company is definitely tough. And I wasn't sure that I would have the amount of time to put into it that I would want. It would take a lot longer to get it out than it would to work with a traditional publisher. And I was definitely interested. I mean, we, you know, self-publishing, we were able to get pretty fantastic reach around the world and certainly within the US and the UK with the first edition, which was great. We did three printings of the first edition, which was pretty amazing. And
Why do you think it was so popular?
I think it struck a nerve with people. And I mean, it's one of only two books dedicated to progressive enhancement, the other one being from the Filament Group, which I believe came out in 2009, Designing with Progressive Enhancement, which was also mm-hmm. from New Writers. Mm-hmm. And so with this edition, I wanted
there is one other book that's kind of about that.
What, Designing with Web Standards?
Yes. Yeah, but which hasn't been updated in like 5 years. So
yes, I worked on that one with you.
Yeah, you did indeed. Yeah. So
I was thinking of ones with specifically progressive enhancement in the title. Yes. But yes, no, absolutely. Your book definitely is from that mindset.
I think that's why your book thrills me so much, is like finds like.
Yep. Exactly. And so you know, I wanted to see what could happen if I did take it to a traditional publisher. And obviously having a very successful self-published first edition put me in a good bargaining position for putting the book out. And so,
which is very unusual, folks. Right. Most of the time it's more like you can go the self-publishing route if you've been published by other people first. Right. So if you've been published by a respected publisher and did well with your book and maybe did a second book, which also did well with that publisher or another publisher, then you have enough reach that you can be successful self-publishing. It's very rare that it's not rare that someone can execute. Well, actually that's rare too, because making a book is hard. But let's say you can do that. Let's say you can write and produce and make that book and self-publish it. The chance that people will actually read it, or that a great number of people will read it, very low, very low, because people don't know who you are. Publishers, in a way, are how authors market themselves.
Absolutely. I was lucky to have folks like you out there celebrating the first edition, so that definitely helped to make it as popular as it was.
It wouldn't have sold, though, if the book didn't have the stuff, that wouldn't have helped at all.
Right. I mean, if it was all sizzle, no steak,
right.
It wouldn't have done as well.
A good ad, nothing kills a bad product faster than a good ad.
Right, exactly. Right,
so, yeah.
When I was talking to them, I didn't go, because I'm like you, I'm not in this for the money. I didn't go for, you know, a huge cash payout or a huge advance or something like that. I mainly went to them and said, like, I want to partner with you guys on this. You know, let's talk about what this looks like. I would like to have control over the visual design of the book. The team that I work with, obviously you guys need to be able to approve those people, but you know, if we're going to work together, I want this to be a partnership. I don't want to just hand everything over to you. Obviously that puts a lot more onus on me to assemble the team and to get things done on time. And I was able to, you know, they gave me approval to do that. And I was able to assemble an amazing team. Steph Troth, who I worked with on the Web Standards Project and on Web Standards Sherpa, was my development editor, and she was amazing. And then I had Craig Cook and Chris Casciano and Steve Faulkner as my tech editors, and their help was just amazing as well. They were an immense help in making the book as awesome as it is. And the team at New Writers was there, they were supportive, they were getting us the answers that we needed in order to do what we were doing. But they also gave us the flexibility to work kind of in our own world. Because I mean, as you know from having worked with them, you know, they have a Word doc template that you need to use, which then makes it easier for them to flow content into the layouts and that sort of thing.
Did they make you do that or no?
We did do that, but we were able to do it later in the process. So original drafts were all done.
You wrote an IA writer.
Yeah, I wrote an IA writer. Everything was in Markdown, and then that went into Google Docs for our editing process. And then we edited in Google Docs and then transferred from Google Docs into the Word template for them.
When they made the ebook, did they go back to your original? Did they go to Google Docs or did they go back to Markdown? Was that of any help to them? Or
I'm not sure if they did. I honestly have not seen an ebook yet. I need to get them to send me a copy of it. I was hoping to be able to to take a look at the EPUB. And
EPUB works fine. The EPUB works great. I have both. Well, thanks to you, I have both. And because I love having it, right? It feels nice. It's pretty cover. Obviously, there's something much more, to me, there's still something much more pleasurable about sitting on the couch with a book that fits in your hand. And there's just something really nice. I'm sorry for the trees, but there's something really nice about that. But just to me, the ability to always have that on a device, to have your book, if I need to remember, my memory is not what it used to be. And if I need to remember something, and actually, and I think if you work in this business at all, nobody's memory is what it used to be, because we're so inundated with new learning every 5 seconds that I can forget all kinds of stuff. But so here's the basic to me, having the defense of progressive enhancement and the ability to get into it, not only from the introductory client-facing, client-friendly part of it, but also like really deep interactivity, really deep JavaScript programming, I think is great. I wanted both, and I checked both before the show, and me happy. So that's good. Mm-hmm. But you don't know how they did that. They did that however they do that. I find ebook making the most makes me think that website development is pretty easy.
Interestingly, go ahead.
Yeah. And then there's Kindle.
Yeah.
And I love my Kindle and I love Kindle books, but man, trying to make an ebook, it makes me feel like it's 2001 again.
No, it's absolutely.
Like, well, the headline's supposed to, like just the vertical spacing of elements and stuff. It's different in Kindle. I don't know why. Somehow it's supposed to be just right. Anyway.
Yeah. I'm with you. I hand coded both of the, or all of the electronic versions, both the EPUB, the Mobi, and the Kindle version for the first edition. And interestingly enough, progressive enhancement works in EPUB too. So
but when you made it, you were actually working from basically web content.
Exactly.
Which is brilliant.
Now the entire first edition is on there. Yeah.
Remember Joe Clark's book on accessibility years and years ago? He wrote the whole thing in HTML and then exported it.
Yep.
But that's still pretty rare among publishers and so on.
Yep, it is. It is. And Howcom and Burbos did their CSS book in HTML as well, and then published it to PDF from via CSS, which was pretty awesome. They wrote about that for a list apart a couple of years back. Cool. It all exists as HTML originally. Obviously, the original files don't have the updates and stuff that we did during the editorial process. But it was cool when I did. I put the entire first edition online for free at adaptivewebdesign.info. And I was able to basically do that from the EPUB source. And so I extracted the EPUB source and then, you know, massaged it a little bit to make it a little bit more web friendly. That became the basis of the full first edition being available online.
Now that it's done, what's next for you? Do you feel like you've got all the writing out of your system and you don't have to, it sounds like you still have lots of things you want to write about.
Yeah, I definitely do. Right now I did the talk on web forms. Web forms have been something that I've been passionate about for a long time. There may be a book in that at some point in the future. New Writers has already been after me to talk about the next book because this one went so smoothly. I'm not sure I'm ready for another book yet, but right now I'm working on a series of blog posts about web forms and about specific aspects. So I've published one so far that was just about labels and how to use labels appropriately.
Where should listeners look for that?
At aarongustafson.com. So aaron-gustafson.com and then / notebook is my blog. And that whole series will be there. I'll give you a link for the show notes.
I've got it.
Got it. All right. So I'll be doing a series there, talking about different pieces of web forms, kind of how to go about choosing the right field types, how to use them appropriately, that sort of stuff. Even something as simple as what's the difference between a checkbox and a radio form control, which I still find sites that don't understand that, especially surveys all the time are using like radio controls. They look like radio controls, but they're actually checkboxes, and it drives me nuts.
Why?
Why does it drive me nuts?
No. Why do they do that?
Why do they do? I don't know. Visual, you know, they want
visual
circles. You know, it's about it's, form over function.
Using font tags and bolds to make a headline.
Yeah. And I mean, to me, it creates some cognitive dissonance for me because I see the circles and I think to myself, okay, I can choose one of many. Right. So if I click on a second one after I've clicked on a first one, the first one should go away and it should check the second one. But that then doesn't happen. And I get really confused.
Yeah, but you're also a developer with 20 years experience. I don't know that.
Maybe not. Maybe it's
Sally just, Public doesn't necessarily have that problem.
But if you look to like standardized testing and stuff like that, we're used to filling in, you know, circles. You don't fill in multiple ones. You know, I don't know. I feel like a lot of that stuff is kind of reinforced over time, and there's a purpose for each thing. And there are some times that I don't think developers really understand the purpose of different HTML elements. I think for a long time, especially folks that were more back-end focused, viewed HTML and CSS and JavaScript to some extent as kind of toy languages that weren't really worth knowing. You only need to know them as far as, you know, what it was that you needed to build. And then you'd focus on your Java or your .NET application or your PHP or whatever. And so I'm trying to kind of take it back to the basics and think about, you know, what are these things doing? Why are they available to us? You know, we only have a limited number of semantics currently in HTML, and so we should know how to use them appropriately and use them well.
Talk to me about your site's open redesign. How are you coming with that? And
it's been kind of slow going. I mean, I relaunched the site, I think, shortly before I joined Microsoft, kind of late last year. I decided that since I wasn't doing as much work through Easy Designs, which is my consultancy with my partner, Kelly McCarthy, we weren't doing as much client work because she's focused on another endeavor and I was joining Microsoft. So I was like, okay, you know, I don't really want to blog there as much. So I decided to relaunch my site, which was a kind of a life blog before. It was aggregating stuff from a bunch of different services, but then that broke. Mm-hmm. I hadn't gotten back to it. So I decided to relaunch the site and I was like, well, I want to get something up there, but I don't want to, like, I know I'm not going to have the time to finalize the design yet. So I've been tinkering here and there as I read something interesting or I get some inspiration or some time, I've been adjusting things, but I mainly just dumped in a bunch of content that I wanted to work with and decided to learn to play around with Octopress and Jekyll, which is what drives it. And originally it was hosted on GitHub. I was just pushing it up there. I've since taken it over to another hosting company with a backup on GitHub. But I'm using it as basically a playground and kind of building up bits and pieces. So when I read Hayden Pickering's piece about quantity queries, I was like, wow, this is freaking amazing. This is really cool stuff. And so that kind of inspired me to play with quantity queries and Flexbox for my speaking engagement page, because there's a lot of, you know, I've spoken at over 100 conferences at this point and done a bunch of workshops and stuff like that. So I've got all of them listed there and I wanted to do something interesting with that. So I have a grid that changes based on how many events there are and how big the screen size is. So, you know, stuff like that, as I kind of get some inspiration, I jump in and I tinker with a page and do some stuff. So I played with that and then I blogged about it because I wanted to share the information that I had learned, kind of putting those two things together. Recently I started playing around with Service Worker and with some of the other optimizations that Google was promoting within their AMP project. So that was kind of interesting. So dealing with some of the pre-caching stuff just to see how I could drive down the download time of the site. And that was pretty interesting. So I posted some of the findings from that as well. So I'm kind of using it as a playground. I definitely don't consider myself an amazing designer. But I'm trying to make something that's highly readable. And
it's very readable. It's very nice. And I think you have a lovely taste. And I think your abilities as a developer play into your design sensibility in nice ways. You have little subtle interactive things that happen that are lovely. And I like the choices you've made on your the page you were just talking about with the speaking page based on Hayden's work, where you pick interesting city screenshots and then do interesting things with them in the background as people hover and so on. I looked at it in a tablet yet, but I imagine things happen there too in different ways. Mm-hmm. I want to thank you. We are running out of time.
Yes.
So I want to
say one last thing.
Please do.
So in an essence, the book that I wrote is sort of my love letter to the web. And so, you know, I absolutely love what I do, and I love that I get to write about it, and that I get to speak about it, and that I get to talk to people at conferences about it. And I'm super appreciative of that. And I'm super appreciative of all you've done to help me have the career that I've had. My way of giving back. And I hope people enjoy reading it as much as I enjoyed writing it, and that they become as passionate about the web as I am.
It's a lovely book. It's called Adaptive Web Design, Crafting Rich Experiences with Progressive Enhancement. Second edition by Aaron Gustafson. Foreword by Jeremy Keith. Published by New Writers, label of Peach Pit. I want to thank Aaron for his time today, Aaron Gustafson. I want to thank our sponsors, DreamHost, Braintree, and Thinkful. We could not do this show without you folks, and their products are great, so please give them a try. We'll be back with another Big Web show next week. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Jeffrey.